I'm Pam Reinagle, and someone was informing me this morning that I'm a weird creature or something like that, because I do both theory and experiments. And I'm trained in neither, so I come from a molecular biology background, actually. And what I do now is visual physiology in the visual system. And some theory, but mostly what I would call more data analysis, trying to find ways of looking at the data we collect to extract its interesting properties. So I work on actually a lot of different things that I wasn't entirely sure what would be most interesting to you guys. I tried to give my best guess of it. What I thought I'd do is, for the first half of my talk, just review several years of work that we've done on how information is encoded in the LPN. When you have dynamic, constantly modulated stimuli like natural scenes or flickering white noise, neurons respond with very precise spike timing, and so I'll just go through that, and that just sort of sets the stage for how we kind of describe the neural responses. And then at that point, there's actually a lot of different directions, which I'm open to seeing how questions guide things. the default will be to go on and talk about how neurons, comparing the response of neurons to natural stimuli. And it was motivated originally by some ideas about optimal coding, but I'll warn you in advance that the ideas were bad. So I don't know if there's a lesson from that, or if that'll be self-evident to this audience, but we can just go ahead. Also, I did not bring my power supply, so the talk can't go more than an hour and a half, and my battery will die. Okay, so this is to remind me to just set up the motivation for why I'm studying the visual system in this way. Vision normally happens in the real world, where stimuli are complex and constantly changing. In contrast to a lot of classical visual physiology, which is study the response of neurons to static stimuli, or very simplified reduced stimuli, in normal situations when animals are trying to accomplish some behavioral task, like jumping through a rock, the objects in the world are moving, the animal is moving through the environment and sweeping its receptor across the stimulus, and so any given cell in that retina or subsequent visual pathway of that animal is getting a continuously changing stream of information. And so that motivated me to look at how information is processed by visual neurons when the stimulus is ongoing, which is now actually quite a routine thing to do, although I think it's true that a decade or two ago it was fairly rare. Okay, the other aspect of the motivation is that animals accomplish these visual processing tasks in real time in single trials. And so I'm interested in knowing what happens, you know, how is the world being represented in the couple hundred milliseconds that the animal might have to make a choice that he'll never make again in his life, as opposed to what kind of information could he accumulate if he could average over many, many seconds and have thousands of presentations of the same stimulus. We will do those things in the lab sometimes in order to measure aspects of the response like the noise, but in the real world, we've got to be able to make a decision based on a single trial. And so that's motivating me to look at the responses in terms of just the response in some short epoch in a single trial and find out how much information could an animal extract from that small, noisy sample about the situation in the world. And I have a feeling you've probably heard a lot of talks from the same point of view. If you look, it's always dangerous, you know. People said you never get off the intro slide, and you had to make that true, right? So it's actually a pretty wet cat, so it looks like he doesn't always succeed. But nevertheless, he seems to succeed in that case. So the visual pathway of mammals, schematically drawn here by Ramon y Cajal, begins with the retina, which has been discussed a lot at this conference. The net result of this analog computation is to send a digital signal to the brain on the optic nerve, which arrives at this relay station called the lateral geniculate nucleus, or LGN. And basically, all visual signals have to pass through this relay in order to reach cortex, where all the complicated processing and consciousness and free will and so on will happen. And I don't study that. I put my electrodes in this structure. I record from single neurons or multiple individual neurons in this structure. And what I'm interested in is the timing of, well, basically the action potentials that they fire, because it's their action potentials are the only aspect of their activity that the cortex finds out about. And I look at this as an example of an information relay. So there's information here, it's trying to get here, and even by anatomist standards, this is supposed to be a relay. And so it seems like an appropriate place to apply principles from information theory to make measurements, how much information is being transmitted along this pathway to that destination, and what aspect of the neural response is responsible for carrying that information. Right. Yes, so there is a whole complex biology of what this structure does, right, which is a mystery, and it's a lot of what I think about, and I haven't put that in this talk, and I could, when I get to that bifurcation point in the middle of the talk, scrap the natural scene stuff and talk about that instead. So I'll take a show of hands then. But right, so this area is drawn here by Cajal in old anatomy textbooks as a unidirectional flow from there to there, but 90% of the inputs to these neurons do not come from the retina. They come from feedback from cortex, they come from other non-visual areas. And so there's been a lot of speculation about what the function is of having this way station. Is it supposed to filter the information or gate the information or implement attention? There are some unique physiological properties that these neurons possess that transforms the pattern from what came into the retina to a different pattern that comes out. In particular, there's a characteristic kind of bursts that I've been studying. And so there's a transform happening here, which might remove, or information, that is to say, it might be a an actual computation, not just a recoding. But what I was going to focus on today was just looking at it as a point along the path. And so a lot of the things I'm going to tell you about these neurons is a property that was computed up here and is inherited completely from its retinal ganglion cell inputs. And I'm not going to focus on the distinction of whether the things originated in the thalamus or are simply being transmitted. That's already computed in the retina. Okay, so these neurons, classically described, look like retinal ganglion cells. They have centers around receptive fields. So if you put a spot of light in the center of the cell's receptive field, it fires a lot of spikes. If you make the spot bigger, it fires less spikes. And that's because there's a suppressive surround. And I put this slide up mainly, partly because some of you are not biologists and might not have seen it as many times, and partly to remind you that there's also a very striking temporal characteristic that's not as often noticed, which is that neurons, for example, fire very briskly at the onset of a preferred stimulus, and then this falls off. They also fire a rebound at the removal of an inhibitory stimulus, like light in this inhibitory surround. And so it's a good idealization to think of these cells as both spatial and temporal differentiators. They're looking for change in either space or time. You would wonder, right? How does the brain, what happens, how does the brain process this, the temporal patterns in terms of what was happening visually? And I guess that's one of the directions that we're pushing in the experiments that we're going to do, where we have stimuli that are changing all the time so that the temporal characteristics of the stimulus are going to drive really complex temporal patterns here. And then try and find out abstractly, how could a decoder extract information from that? So maybe I'll address that a little bit. Yeah, so here is, to give the background, this is supposed to be a depiction of a screen where they're flashing flashlights. In fact, I have a great video of the actual experiment from the 1960s, which you won't leave, if anybody wants to see it later upstairs, but I didn't bring it. Anyway, so the flashing light, and most places in the world that they flash light doesn't make the cell fire, but if they happen to hit the spot that the neuron's receptive to, it makes the cell fire. And so this is the voltage extracellularly recorded from the neuron. These things are axis sensors, and this bar above shows the time approximately that the flashlight came on, although I think that's recorded by like a guy with a pencil on the paper trace. These are early data. Another thing that's not often known about these data is that they were recorded in an awake behaving cat in 1960. It was only in 61 that they realized that it would be easier to study it in an anesthetized cat, and they showed that all these properties were the same under anesthesia, and on that basis alone, pretty much the next 40 years of neurophysiology in the system was done in anesthetized animals, including mine, so I guess 50 years and counting. Okay, so this is just to summarize what I said before, is that I think of these cells as responding to change either in space, differences between the center and the surround, or in time. So this is a caricature of what you might see if you just had a random flickering, you know, stimulus with different light at every possible position, and then you ask, on average, what kind of stimulus might have preceded a spike from this neuron, and on average, it would have been one that was bright in the cell's receptacle center and or dark in the surround. That was a pretty cryptic explanation. But then here is a similar idea, which is what kind of temporal pattern, luminous as a function of time, in that cell's receptive field would have driven a spike. And these are just hand-drawn cartoons, but the idea is it responds to a transition from dark to light, which is a non-cell. And so you would, from looking at these, think that anything that was constant in space might not drive the cell at all, or anything that was constant in time might not drive the cell at all. And if we get to the natural scenes half of the talk, I'll remind you why we think that is a good thing. Yes. I'm going to get to that momentarily, although I'm not going to say a whole lot about it. So here's just an example of a neuron like this responding to a broadband signal. So here's one of these randomly flickering checkerboards that I just described to you. And here's where I hope you'll be able to hear the firing of a neuron whose receptive field is about four squares near the middle of this. And so its center is about four squares in the middle, and then its surround is, you know, maybe that big. The receptive field is completely inside this screen. And let's see if we can hear it. You can all tell what feature it's responding to. So if you show that same flickering checkerboard a couple hundred times, and you make raster plots, so here I've got a tick mark for the time of every... So that exact same one, multiple times, yeah. Yeah, so operationally, the way I define the receptive field structure of these neurons is I show a flickerboard. Well, first I use a flashlight, and I do the Hubble experiment, and I try and find out about how big the areas that it's responding to. And then I put a visual stimulus that's going to cover what seems to be like maybe at least 10 times that diameter. And then I use this flickering checkerboard, and I correlate the spikes with the temporal, spatiotemporal pattern. And so I'm going to ask, basically for each pixel, what was the average time course preceding a spike? And any pixel that shows correlation with spike time, I will define as being part of the receptive field. So for sort of linear correlated spiking. That's operationally. But nothing in my theory really depends very much on defining the receptive field. So I haven't really worked on that recently. Yeah, everything that I'm going to say is, so basically, every experiment we do, we pick some stimulus ensemble, right? And then I can make a bunch of statements that are basically true of the discrimination of stimuli within that ensemble and do not apply at all to other stimulus ensembles. And so there's a sort of a meta description that's needed, and that's actually one of the things I'm really interested in working on in my lab right now, is describing the neural response to all the stimuli within one ensemble, then another ensemble, then another ensemble, you know, giving the cell time to adapt to their new steady state behavior in each condition, and then try and come up with some parameterization that says, now I can tell you how the neuron responds as a function of parameters. So in other words, the description of the neuron as opposed to just its behavior in one environment. But that's experimentally really hard because you need to record the cells for like days, which we sometimes accomplish. Okay, so at risk of repeating my other people, but just to make sure everyone's on board here, this is a raster. Every row is the data from one trial. Every tick mark is the time of one action potential. And the point of this, especially sort of the point of the first half of my talk, is that when you have stimuli like this, neurons respond with very brisk responses in very constrained periods of time, separated by gaps when they don't fire at all. So they have these very sparse responses with high temporal precision and very little what you might think of as background firing, you know, spikes that don't belong to a visual response. So I'm going to have a few slides just quantifying how precise is this, and then we'll get on to whatever we want to talk about next. Okay, so here's my brief touch on this dynamics of the center surround. So to look at just how the cells process temporal change, we've isolated the dimension of time and just thrown out the dimension of space. And so we just make full field stimuli that are uniform in luminance, and every stimulus frame, you just pick a new luminance at random. well, it could, the sequence could be defined in many ways. It could be a natural sequence or a random sequence. But the whole field is going to have spatially uniform luminance, huge compared to the classically defined receptor field of the neuron. So all that's changing is time. And one of the things that drove me to the lab is that I tried to get a couple of physiologists to do this experiment for me, and they refused. Because they said that it's known, of course, that cells have centers around antagonistic receptor fields, and that they won't respond to a uniform luminance, and therefore this would not drive any spikes, so they would never waste the life of a cat on it. So I went to a lab and learned how to do experiments and ran that stimulus, and the responses looked just like I showed you before. So this is the full field luminance function of time in one of these experiments, and these are the responses at specific times. Very precisely defined responses, silence in between, and data just like this have been collected for a long time before me in retina, and I think it's essentially the same phenomenon. Oh yeah, so what you learn from this slide is that even though cells subtract their surround from their center, that does not prevent them from responding to uniform luminance if it's changing in time. Yeah, and I forgot to get back to your point, which is because the dynamics are different, because the response to the center is faster and thoroughly easy than the response to the surround. So if everything's changing rapidly, a temporally changing stimulus is not zeroed out, even though if you just look at a snapshot in space, you would think it might be. Okay, and that's the total that I have to contribute on that one. Okay, so we can use spatial flicker temporal flicker without spatial structure to look at the features of the code. Just gave me a certain technical advantage in some of my analysis. And this just summarizes the conclusions that have come out of my way of looking at it, very similar to the perspectives that many other labs have come up with similar data. So I'm going to walk you through the way I formalized it. I won't really have time to go into some of the other ones, but in any case, the way I would dissect the nature of this response is to talk about three different aspects. One is the precision, which is how precisely are the spikes time-locked to the stimulus time. More or less independent of that, at least conceptually independent of that, is the reliability, which is if you show the same stimulus twice, how reliable is the number of spikes that you get in each of those times? So that's reliability. And then the third is whether there's any additional information or important visual information in the patterns of spikes above and beyond each spike's time locking to the stimulus. So basically, there is a temporal pattern, which is just because every spike is locked with some precision to the stimulus. And the question is that it, or is there some additional patterning within the spike train, like the spikes relative to other spikes that carries additional information? And that is actually the most complicated analysis, and I should say the bottom line is that it probably contributes the least amount of information to the neural code. So I'll just tell you my conclusions on these points is that the precision of the LGN in these kind of conditions can be sub-millisecond in the timing of spikes. So within experimental error and so on, I would say it could be as good as the retina. The second is that the spike timing is very reliable, so if it were a Poisson process, you would expect the variance to be equal to the mean, and the variance is much less than the mean. A little bit more variable than the retina, but not much. And we think that there is information coded in spike patterns of some neurons, but it's a quite subtle effect. Okay, so then, I have like a whole talk at each of those points. I was just going to walk you through the data on point one, but is there a question? So the most, of course, again, within the constraints of the stimuli that I chose and so on, the most information that I was ever able to find in the patterns was 20% of the total information. Whereas the precision, which I'll show you in a minute, can be orders of magnitude difference in the information depending on how precisely you look at it. And the reliability may be 30%. So if you make a model neuron that's a Poisson, that has Poisson variability, you know, you lose maybe 30% of the information compared to the true neuron. And so these are both relatively subtle effects, tens of percent, and this is a huge effect, which is why I thought I'd let's focus on it, even though from the theoretical point of view, the other two might be more interesting. Oh yeah, and then I kind of intimated in the beginning that in these particular neurons, one of the special features that doesn't immediately generalize to the study of other neurons is these particular bursts that they have. And that's something that I work on, but it's less general. Okay, so here's an analysis that I borrowed from the retinal literature from Mike Berry and Marcus Meister, actually, where we take the PSDH, this is the histogram, the probability of a spike in every 1 millisecond time bin, in one of these experiments, and so you end up with these peaks in firing rate that are separated by these silent troughs, and we just fit a Gaussian to every one of these peaks, and we describe, I think in this study, we defined the width of a peak as 2 sigmas of the x bit Gaussian, which is how wide are the peaks, and so we get numbers that are like 2, 3, 4, 1 millisecond, and so on. Most of the firing responses are constrained to a period of on the order of a couple milliseconds. So for this particular cell, over the course of an 8-second-long stimulus, it fired 179 of these firing events. And this is a distribution of their precisions. They range from sub-millisecond to about 4 milliseconds, and on average, around 2 milliseconds. There's a technical detail here. If you're a technical audience, I'll bring it up. The proper way to do this analysis, which is how it was done in the retina, is actually to just ask what is the scatter in the first spike of every firing event, right? Because otherwise you confound two issues. How precise is the time of the event versus how long is the event? You could have a very precise event that had a long duration. In these data, the firing events typically had 1 spike, or maybe 2. And so I actually, it didn't make much difference, so I actually glossed over it in this analysis. So as I moved on to other data sets, I realized that it was an important feature of the analysis, and I do it a little bit more find these days. And this is the results of a similar analysis from a bunch of other cells that just shows that it's not unusual. This cell that I analyzed here, I think, is this one here, and there are some are a little bit less precise and some a little bit more, but on average, we're definitely in the order millisecond range, a couple milliseconds of spike timing precision. On cells, off cells. This is to point out that the times of these spikes are actually a very well conserved from cell to cell in different animals. So one concern that I had when I saw those previous data was that it could be that every neuron, over the course of development, it has certain dendritic arbors and certain connectivity, and maybe it gets one retinal ganglion cell input or maybe three, and there'd be all kinds of variability from cell to cell, but then each cell, once wired in, would basically be a little machine that would do the same thing every time you challenged it. So I wanted to know whether we were studying sort of idiosyncratic, unique response patterns of individual cells, or whether this was a generalized code. And what we found is that within cells of the same class, and these are broad, crudely, classically defined classes, like on X cells, you could take any on X cell from any animal and show statistically very related in their spike timing responses. I just picked two here that are especially similar, but that were recorded from two different animals 6 months apart. We used the same white noise flicker, obviously, in both experiments, and the PSDH peaks are shown in black for one cell and in red for the other cell. There was actually a latency difference between the two cells of 3 milliseconds, just across the board, which I subtracted out. But once I did a single latency shift to align the two spike trains, their peaks align with much more accurately than a peak width. Right, so the temporal pattern of spikes is conserved, and that's in spite of the fact that many other things may not be conserved. So the firing rate could be tenfold different between two cells, and yet the times of their peaks could be identical. The cell that has fewer, the lower firing rate, just has a subset of the peak. So you have a peak like this one that just doesn't happen for that, for the red cell. This is the whole firing event, because I didn't, this is before I started paying attention to that distinction, but yeah, this is the whole firing event. So there's a couple of spikes in each of these peaks, one to three, I would say. And the tick marks above are the, those are not the spike trains, those are the identified peak times. How does it depend on the luminance? I have not varied that parameter systematically. Well, you get these So in the LGN, we have the nicely behaved X and Y cells, and then everything else we call a W cell. And that's actually one of the things that I've gotten interested in also. My problem is there's too many things I'm interested in, and not enough people in my lab, but is looking at what is the diversity of representations in the LGN, and there's this whole class of cells. So in the retinal literature, you know, there's a bunch of different kinds of ganglion cells, and people kind of work through and study all of them. But in the thalamus, people have just not characterized the cells that were hard to characterize. And so, yeah, there are these other cells, but which not as known. These are all X cells. They have bigger receptive fields and more mushy responses, and so they're in that population, but they're not in this. Yeah. This is an anesthetized cat. If there's an effect on the noid, it's pretty subtle. Of depth of anesthesia, when you go into an awake animal, a lot of people in awake animals observe much higher variability, but it's not still clear to me whether that's because of experimental variability. It's much more difficult to control your stimulus reproducibly from trial to trial as the animal can also be looking around. but differences between like lighter and deeper surgical anesthesia. The effects, I mean, you might be able to pull them out with analysis, but just crudely looking at them, it's not real obvious. Firing rates go down. And that's probably the main difference between the different cells that I record. The firing rates can vary a lot, and that's probably physiological state, but then the spikes that do happen only happen during the precise times that they're described. The anesthetized cat, yeah. Yeah, but I really, it's important to look at this in an awake animal, and that's, you know, sort of an enduring problem with the disease data. Oh, okay, let me see. I don't know if I have that slide loaded. I don't have that slide loaded, but I can show it to you. So what happens is, to a first approximation, the highest firing rate cells have a lot of firing events, and now I'm trying to cartoon like those columns in the raster. And then a low firing rate cell would have maybe a subset of those events, right? But the alignment between them is almost as good, right? Or some of the events just become very weak and noisy. It really seems like that. In that we compared all the, we didn't actually go after this on purpose, we just went post hoc through all the data where we used the same seeds. And so we didn't have a huge sample where we had the same white noise sequence, but we went through all the cells that we had ever recorded with that white noise sequence, and they're in our paper, and I can show you the slide, but the least matching one might actually be a different subclass. But I think it's, you know, they're pretty well described that way. And my hunch, just to throw out something for argument, is that the differences between cells, you know, probably have more to do with differences in arousal in the anesthetic prep, because sometimes we would record the same cell for 12 or 24 hours, and 24 hours later it would have changed from this to this. And I think actually it's possible that all the cells really have the same fundamental response pattern, and we're just sampling at a different moment in its life. I said I haven't varied it experimentally. So we're pushing these cells with a very high bandwidth signal, the white noise, and it's very high luminance, so it's easily phototopic. It's not particularly high contrast. The luminances were, it's moderately high contrast, I would say. So it's a strong stimulus, and I know, and I believe that these parameters will change as a function of stimulus. So, for example, as you go to lower and lower contrast, this kind of behavior persists for a long time, but at some contrast, right, they become noisy and less precise and less reliable. And so, yeah, we're sampling sort of part of the space of the zone. Articulated the sort of underlying motive of the question, but just guessing what it might be, I could comment a little bit on natural scenes. So we have a limited amount of data where we just ran movies. I mean, they weren't cat cam movies, although those exist in the world now, but they were just, you know, films of, you know, walking through the woods kind of natural movies. And what you see is epochs during the response where the responses look like this, and other epochs where they look more like the responses of sign grading. So if you look at the PSDH, you have periods where there's sparse responses of peaks, and then you have some other period where it's doing this. As far as the mean, the firing rate is a function of time. And what can I say about that? Right, these are precise, they're also reliable, so they're, you know, order millisecond precision and Fanon factor, which Mike just measured as a measure of reliability. They're maybe 1/4 the variability of a Poisson process, but you get out here to these slowly varying responses. Can everyone see what I do there? These slowly varying responses, then you get, you know, basically, precision isn't even a well-defined number anymore, and you know, it goes to Poisson in like statistics. So both things are going on during sort of natural experience. The ways that I have of measuring the informational content of the spectrum, which are very limited, as I'm sure you all know, the ways I have of estimating the information suggest that most of the visual information is encoded by these spikes. So if you just say how many bits about the world do you get from, it's mainly coming from the high-precision spikes and not from this, but that might be a limitation of how I measure the information. That explains, oh yeah, sure. So here is, you know, so in one of the movies that I showed, there's a period where the camera's actually mounted on a car. This is from Hans von Hatteren's archive, if any of you know it. And the car is like driving around and groaning in, and every once in a while, he'll, you know, make a turn, and a bunch of big high contrast tree branches will go sweeping across the receptor field. And they'll go, and I have a movie of that if anyone wants to see it. And then there'll be a time when the sun's just kind of like glinting in the cell's receptor field, and it's just kind of slowly changing, and there's no real spatial features, and then it does some of this. So it's the question, you know, and I think it's an interesting question, actually, if we had ground truth as where how the information was being transferred through the system, what fraction of the information is carried in these responses, but I'm not that confident that our measurements are objective about that. Right, so Koenig's lab actually has done this experiment where they mounted a camera on a cat and an eye tracker. Peter Koenig in Zurich, I guess. Right, so they mounted the camera on a cat and a little eye tracker so that they could, like, he's running around and they're measuring like what is in his field of view and where he's fixating. And so they, he's had a poster on that. I don't know if it's public. Yeah. Right, right. So I guess what I was suggesting from this point of view is that the cells definitely operate in different regimes, and we might have to come up with some meta-statistic of like how much of the time. This is what I was saying before, which is really like the description of the neuron as such, that says as a function of whatever it is that matters. And we know in fact it's not just the power spectrum, because we could take stimuli with the power spectrum of the natural scene and they give us a different answer than the natural scene. So something about the phase structure probably is important. So we say, what is the feature of the stimulus that determines which regime you're in? and then what is the cell, can you understand how the cell is going to respond as a function of these parameters, and then measure those parameters and map the change and say, okay, 10% of the time the cell is firing in the sparse tracer gene, and 90% of the time it's firing in this gene, and the information transfer is, you know, I think you need somehow a, hopefully it won't be a whole bunch, a grab bag of separate codes that we paste together. You know, hopefully it'll be some kind of a parameter that just smoothly degrades across that. I think it's a good thing. Yeah. So. Right. Yeah, so what, so the experiments that are actually going on in my lab right now are measuring properties of the neural code as a function of contrast, and looking at how the neurons adapt and what their coding properties are under different contrasts and trying to piece together the. But I think it's too early even to do the image statistics analysis because we don't know what feature of the image is important for determining which gene you're in. So I would hesitate, you know, to say, oh, I spend a lot of my time looking at this stuff, right? Because I find it interesting. You know, there is a whole literature that has studied, you know, the way that neurons are firing in this other regime. And I'm not trying to disregard it. So in this, fair enough. So the last thing I wanted to say about timing precision is that it actually matters for the encoding of information, and it doesn't follow tautologically. Right? So it could have been the case that my stimulus frame was updating every 8 milliseconds, which is true, and the neuron only fires at the time of the frame change. Right, and so it fires with an amazing, you know, 0.1 millisecond precision only at that particular time, but the time is not in any way determined by what the stimulus was, right? Maybe all the stimulus information that discriminated one flickering pattern from another could have been in, like, the probability that you fire at that time, or the number of spikes that you fire at that time. So logically speaking, just because we observe precision doesn't mean that it's carrying any visual information. So this is a separate analysis. And so what I'm doing is applying information theory to measure the mutual information between the spike train and the stimulus. Obviously this is derived from Shannon's theory of communication, but I'm using specifically the method that Steve Strong and colleagues in the Alex group proposed for looking at spike trains as strings. You could take a neuron's response, which is just spikes as a function of time, like some continuous variable, and you could bin it into small time bins, and then write, you know, for every time bin in this vector, the value is going to be equal to the number of spikes in that bin. Whatever, good idea. And then the information that the spike train carries with the stimulus is somehow the determined by the joint statistics between the distribution of these patterns and the distribution of the stimuli that it goes through. So that, I assume that it would probably be pointless when you need to review information theory, because you guys mostly know it better than I do. So I thought I would skip over the technicalities of how this calculation is done, but simply say there exists a method which we can discuss offline for trying to estimate how much information the words or the strings of that you get from a spike train response, how much information that carries about the visual stimulus that you go through. Is it okay for me to please do that, or do you want me to talk to you about that? Okay. So the thing to know about this measure of information is that it depends on two parameters. How long of a word do you consider in the neural response, and how finely do you bin? And so for the analysis I'm showing you here, we've done our best to implement an extrapolation procedure where we measured the result as a function of word length as far as we could, and then tried to extrapolate to infinite word length. A very dicey procedure, but anyway, that's what we've attempted there. And now we've asked, how does our result, so this is the information taking into account all the patterns you want in the spike train, how does that depend on how finely you bin the spike train? And so if you bin it at 100 millisecond resolution, which would be the time scale of a Hubel-Weigel firing rate type experiment, there's basically no information that would distinguish any white noise stimulus from any other. If you bin it at 8 milliseconds, which is the frame rate of our stimulus, you certainly get a lot more information, but you can still get more and more visual information out of the spike train as we look at the spike times to higher and higher precision. just pointing out the whole log scale, we're down to half a millisecond here, and that's the shortest thing that we could sample. Oh, no, it's probably worth at least giving that much of the concept of the method. So what we're doing is we're gonna have some white noise visual stimulus, and we're gonna get the responses of the neuron in a bunch of trials. And the way we're gonna measure the information is how much is your uncertainty about the spike pattern reduced when I fix the stimulus, right? So we're gonna measure the overall entropy when the stimulus is varying by saying, I'm gonna take my word from all different times in the stimulus and ask what is the distribution of possible patterns that you ever get for any stimulus in this ensemble. And that'll be the total entropy of the neural response. And I'm gonna compare that to the noise entropy, which is how many different responses did I get when the stimulus was the same, so this is the same stimulus repeated over and over. So that's gonna be the conditional entropy. And if the response is completely deterministic, right, that would be zero, and the information would equal the entropy rate. But of course, there's some variability there. So the important, the question that you asked is, am I assuming anything about latency? The answer is no, because I don't need to know anything about the stimulus to do this calculation. I don't need to know any of its parameters, the structure, or how far back in time it matters. We just have to be able to reproduce it. It's a count. So if that was a bin, that would be a two. It's not strictly a binary count. Okay, so this suggests that in this regime where the cells are firing precisely, the spike timing actually carries visual information about what particular kind of pattern preceded it. And let's summarize here. So each LPN cell can fire with order millisecond precision if you give it the right stimulus. Precise timing that it. So the precise times of those responses are conserved patterns from cell to cell in the population. Obviously, different cell types have different patterns, different stimuli evoke different patterns, but the pattern for a given cell type is the same from animal to animal. And there's visual information there. Okay, and then this is the slide I had up before. So I talked about precision. The story about reliability is pretty much exactly the same as was already found in the retina. Namely, that the cells become reliable in how many spikes they fire as a result of refractoriness, and this only kicks in when the firing rate gets high. Okay, and that also makes it easy to understand why these responses are reliable and these are noisy, because here the firing rate is either zero or high. You're always in one of the two regimes where you're very reliable, whereas here the firing rate's, you know, sort of always low and intermediate, and so refractoriness doesn't much affect the precision, and these become more. The information and patterns I'm just not going to go into there. I sort of gave you the bottom line numbers on it before. But so here's our verification point. I don't know how long you guys want to sit here, and whether you'd rather talk about bursts in the thalamus or natural sequence cells. And if you don't vote, I'll just go on. Nobody wants to vote. Okay, bursts offline if somebody cares. We can talk about it. Okay, so as we all know, natural scenes have very reproducible lower statistics. In particular, if you take a still natural image and you ask what is the correlation of the luminance of pixels as a function of the distance between them, every pixel is perfectly correlated with itself, and the correlation falls off gradually with distance. So there's a lot of spatial correlation, which you can express in the power spectrum, because the power drops off as 1 over the spatial frequency to an exponent. It's all very, very well known and shown by many people. So David Field has some pattern, Dan Lieberman, and many others. And this is just to remind you the same thing is true of natural temporal stimuli. This is an example of a natural stimulus that was recorded, again, by Constant Hatterin with a photodiode strapped to his head walking around in the woods. And just the luminance is a function of time at one fly photoreceptor diameter, I think. And what you see is you have these periods where, you know, you have some variability, and then, I don't know, you went under the shadow of a tree or something, and it became very dim and got bright again. It's almost like you have sort of quasi-stationary statistics with these jumps. But if you look at these data over this is 4 seconds of a 45-minute long recording. If you do statistics on the whole thing, you find that on average, you know, every point in time is, you know, highly correlated luminance with neighboring points in time, and this falls off again. And so similarly, we get a dependence, a power law dependence of temporal frequency, as a function of temporal frequency. So the natural environment has spatial and temporal correlations, and we already talked about the fact that LGMs must have field differentiators. I have to apologize and speaking to the people who discovered these things, but anyway. So here is just the crudest possible MATLAB simulation. You take a natural image and you make this ugly looking square tennis around receptive field, just to demonstrate the point quickly that you can correlate. So if you convolve an image by a tennis around receptive field, you cut down the correlations except within the correlation with your receptive field. And it looks bad because it's a square thing with edges. But here it's not, I think that's to scale actually. So this is really just an illustration slide. This is not a true analysis, but just to, I actually made this slide for a biology audience. Assuming this point would not be at all obvious, that these spectrum type receptive fields would remove correlations, and similarly, this is actually just, you know, an example of something that could be a transient temporal response to the temporal sequence. There it is, scaled, but that's just blown up. I just took a cycle of a sinusoid, and if you can solve it by the temporal stimulus, you remove almost all of the temporal correlations, and you flatten the power spectrum. So LGN neurons are doing, and retinal ganglion cells neurons are doing this decorrelation on natural scenes. And here I'm just reviewing the past literature, because it led us to this idea that natural scenes might be the best possible stimulus for these neurons. Like, they've optimized their code for a particular statistical ensemble. And if we imagine, you know, we just hypothesize that the code in the nervous system is optimal for natural scenes, you would think that the optimizations that it put in place to be really good for natural scenes would make them inefficient for putting other scenes. For example, natural scenes, so here's just another case. This is a natural scene, temporal sequence up top. And here is again the spectrum as a function of temporal frequency shown down here. In order to encode that natural scene efficiently, what the visual system does is ramp up the high frequency, compress the low frequency, so it whitens the output of the neuron relative to the input of the response. And you would think, well, a white noise stimulus is going to be, you know, ruined by that, because it was already optimal and now you've skewed the spectrum. So we had this idea that maybe that neurons would be optimal, would encode natural scenes better than other stimuli. And this is what I said was a bad theory, and it turned out to be a wrong theory. And so the rest of what I was going to show you is just the data that we collected on that. Spare you walking through the historical sequence here, but we did these experiments using a CRT monitor to display that green stimulus. And we got this result that surprised us at a time, that the natural scene is actually sort of worked with these two stimuli. The white noise is the best, and this thing with that only matches the spectrum of the natural scene is 1 over F noise is intermediate. And we thought, oh, I know what we did wrong. It's because this stuff is all near zero and it's getting squashed by our CRT. So then we redid the experiments with an analog display. So we used LEDs with 16-bit grayscale and kilohertz refresh, and took away all of the artifacts that had gone into the monitors, and it didn't change the thing. Yes, that's right. Well, so of course this is I don't know, a spherical cow experiment or something, right? Because this is one pixel of recorded nature. So this is another sample from the Thompson-Hadron data set where it's like the input, essentially a point as far as these cells are concerned. So you can say it's a model of, you know, the input is a function of time at the center of the cell's receptive field. That includes all the structure that's introduced by a person walking around and moving his head around, looking at things and whatever. So there's like ego motion built in, but it's not highly controlled. Because there's a crude approximation to the time sequence that would result from the combination of the statistics of the scene and the behavior of the animal combined. But But yeah, it's not a final model. And actually, I'm even saying this is something worth getting back to. Yeah. So I think that's one of the main reasons that the motivating theory behind this was not very good is because we imagined that adaptation was somehow an evolutionary process, right? That over evolutionary time you get centers around receptacles and transient responses and mechanisms were hardwired and would make you sort of statically good for one ensemble, whereas, as you point out, the neurons are actually very active and adapting, which is, I imagined, might turn out to be an important part of why the neurons were able to encode this signal as well. Right. So what did I think? I said, the neurons will encode this signal really well because that's the thing they evolved to do. This is some weird thing that they would never see in nature, and even if you did see it, you would never care about it. And so they'll encode it very badly. And we'll find out that, you know, the 1 over F spectrum is important because this either will or won't be predicted by the 1 over F noise. And we'll find out that adaptation is crucial to this because if the neurons didn't adapt, they couldn't possibly be encoding small fluctuations here in these huge fluctuations. Yeah, so the cells do adapt. So presumably at steady state, you know, they're doing the best they possibly can with this stimulus, which turns out to be better than they can do dynamically here. And maybe it's because they can't adapt fast enough to keep up with the changing statistics. Or something. I mean, obviously, this stimulus is a much, much lower entropy. So there's less information in it to be encoded. But as far as we can tell, the cells are far from the limit of having encoded all of it. So let me just say what that is. And part of the reason for presenting this really is because, it was sort of a weak theory that resulted in some good experiments that now sort of lack a strong theory to work with. And so it's been a project that kind of annoys me and sits in the background, and I keep thinking that we'll relook at these data in some new way and discover something much more interesting than this. So it's partly just like letting you guys know that these data are here for those of you who are theorists. Okay. So this is just a little bit to the question of whether the responses that we looked at with the white noise flicker were representative of the kind of responses we're going to be analyzing. And so here are PSDHs from the white noise. This is exactly comparable to the experiments we talked about before. This is only half a second, so we've expanded the scale a little bit here. And here's the response to the natural stimulus. And so you can see that we definitely do get these sharp peaks and sparse responses for some parts of the natural stimulus. Others are broader, and there are other, I don't know if we had for this stimulus, but there are stimuli that would give, like, this more speedy varying thing. There was never a systematic difference in the firing rates. They might differ, but not in any consistent way. So it's not that the cells respond, like, very little to one's response to the other. So what we are doing here is statistically matching. So operationally, what happened here was that we randomized so we had a luminance as a function of time, the one-dimensional vector for the natural scheme, natural time course, and then we just randomized the time indices of that vector to make the white noise. So the distribution of luminances is identical. The temporal correlations are lost. And of course, the sort of strength of that white noise stimulus is going to depend on what your frame rate was. You know, so sort of like bandwidth is of your white noise. And I don't think that's a strong explanatory factor in these data. So for example, at one point we did this experiment, which even we thought was stupid, of having the white noise be, 1.2 kilohertz. Very, very fast. So it was 1.2 kilohertz, which just happened to be the recorded, the precision with which we knew the natural scenes. We just drew a new random variable every every 0.8 milliseconds. We thought, okay, that's going to look like mean gray, and the cell's not going to respond at all, and so that's sort of a dumb experiment, but at least it'll be our reductio ad absurdum, and the neurons still responded better to that than to light. And if you filtered it by the cell's receptive field, the discrepancy becomes even more shocking. Right? So the filtering would only make the discrepancies worse, not different. These are still fill fields. There are some movie data, which give the same qualitative finding. So not a lot of it. Okay, so this was just an analysis of how much does this precision that I measured fall apart as we go from white noise to natural scenes, and it gets a little bit to what we talked about before. The white noise had this distribution of precisions between like 1 and 4 milliseconds. For, you know, each dot is the average precision of a firing event for that cell, or whatever that is, 8 cells or something, for these three different stimuli. And it's true that when you go to the natural scenes, the responses get less precise, but it's a pretty small effect. I mean, considering that, I forgot the numbers off the top of my head, but something like, you know, I don't know, a classical person would say these neurons roll off their response at 30 hertz or something, and something like 90% of, or 98% of the power in this analysis is above 30 hertz, and 98% of it is below there, and you know, so these stimuli are much, much slower, and yet the precision degrader is only a little, so. So actually the whole, I don't know why I didn't have this slide earlier in the talk, so the whole project was actually inspired by this amazing result from the bullfrog auditory neuron, which was Fred Riecke's work, with also with Bill, in which they measured the information rate using a linear reconstruction method, so a different way of estimating it, to either a naturalistic stimulus, in this case an auditory stimulus with the spectrum of a bullfrog call, or a white noise stimulus that was matched with statistics. And they found that this is the transmitted information of the neurons with the mutual information estimate, bound on the mutual information. And they found that the neurons encoded, you know, some information about the white noise, but in every single case, more information about the natural stimulus, even though this natural stimulus had a tiny fraction of the entity of the white noise. And that result was true. I actually replotted the data from tables in their paper, which made me really appreciate tables. Because I could divide by things easily that I wanted to know. And so this is the information rate in just bits per second raw throughput of the neuron. This is bits per spike, so a lot more information was encoded by every spike that was fired. And this is the fractional coding efficiency, so as a fraction of the total entropy of the neural response as sort of defined within that framework that they were measuring. The neurons were more efficient and approaching, and this is actually analysis that they discussed in their paper, approaching almost 100% efficiency for some neurons with the natural stimulus. And so it was this result, you know, in the frog, that sort of inspired me to think that the LGN neurons similarly might encode their natural scenes best, especially because other people had demonstrated the predicted fact that the LGN neurons had some characteristics of optimal coding for natural scenes, like this white spectrum. This is the auditory nerve, right? They were divided into two different frequency response categories in the paper, which I didn't. Spikes or Well, this was a linear reconstruction method, and so there isn't a need for repeating trials, right? You just have a long, unique instantiation of your stimulus ensemble, right? And then you're correlating the each, like, so how long, how many data? I don't remember. What's the concern? What's the, you're worried about that? You want to know whether, for example, the, and, I don't know, but I mean, how much data there are? Right. For the what? For the natural? Yeah. My editors tell me that's not a word, but. It's not an actual bullfrog call. Because you are approaching 100% for the spectrum. Okay. Although for whatever it's, yeah, for whatever it's worth, doing using reconstruction, this information would pop up here. Although you have to be fair because that's a lower bound on the entropy output, right? Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Efficiency that's required to have the flexibility to handle the ensemble of ensembles. Yeah. So, another, not that I have any reputation of that, but another perspective that, you know, I have about these experiments is that this is a very special case in which the animal has the power to evolve the signal. Right? Frogs get to make their colors. right? And so it's very difficult to disentangle in this experiment whether we're looking at how the auditory system has optimized for like pathologically relevant stimulus versus how the vocal tract has optimized to produce a signal that far goes into the hearing, right? And so it's, whereas in the case of vision, for the most part, every stimuli are not produced with an intent of being seen. Unsatisfying study for me is that you can convince yourself of like completely polar opposite things as being obvious, and so it's, at the end it's hard to know what you would consider surprising. Because you know, on one hand, you know, on some days we'd wake up and say, well, there's no point in doing this experiment because the visual system didn't evolve. Let's talk to David Hubel, and he'd be like, why are you showing this flickering trigger? The visual system didn't even do this for that, you know, and you know, you got to show it something, you know, reasonable that you could see or that you would care about or could characterize. And on the other hand. Yeah. Anyway, no, so I'm trying to remember what else I have here. Right, so the cat had the opposite result, which we just went through. I guess I haven't shown you the data, I've just been telling you this is how it came out. So this is the example with the analog LED stimuli where we ruled out all these artifacts due to the stimulus generation. So information rates for all of our neurons went down when we went from a between a white noise and a natural scene that were matched for their variant and underlying luminance distributions. The natural stimulus, less information was encoded about the natural stimuli per second. We saw that, we're like, oh, that's okay because you know the baud rate of the stimulus is less but for spikes, surely, and you know, it's less for spike. We said, well, but it must be more efficient, but no, it's less fractional efficiency, so fractional efficiency as a and now I'm using this other way of calculating information, the bounce back using this direct measure, less information per bit of stimulus entropy. It was also less sparse with natural scenes. It was also more variable with natural scenes. We kept trying to come up with the thing that was optimized until we kind of realized that it was a stupid endeavor. Oh, this is just another one of our controls showing that if you use movies, so we thought, oh, well, it's just because we're using full-field stimuli, and that must be stupid. So now, it didn't reproduce very well on PowerPoint, but these are a bunch of adjacent frames of a movie taken in the real world. And again, we just randomized the pixels in space and time to make a white noise movie with the same underlying luminance distribution. And there's more information encoded by the white noise there. And just from looking at all the data and scratching our heads a long time, my take is that most of the information in the natural scenes is encoded when the cells do this. And when you give it white noise, they do this all the time. And I think that's sort of all, in a way, that's sort of all you need to explain that. Okay, so what? Elgin's driven well by natural stimuli, so they respond, which is good. The precision to me is pretty surprising. Here's those numbers I was groping for. So most of the stimulus energy is, you know, below 10 hertz. But most of the neural responses are precise to less than 15 milliseconds, and for every cell we recorded from with natural scenes, there were at least some firing events that were in 2 milliseconds precision. So to get all the visual information out of that curve I was showing you before, information is a function of precision, you still needed to go to the 2 milliseconds before it would level off. So precision matters even when natural scenes have low frequencies. The white noise is that we've been using is not a bad model for natural stimuli because the kind of response events that we see, you know, do occur during natural stimuli. No, they have not applied any model, right? What I'm saying is that the responses can be sparse and precise and reliable with natural scenes for those properties that we've been characterizing about the responses. See, a lot of the stuff that I've been doing and talking about is really looking at the neural responses and not actually analyzing the stimulus per se. So I haven't been building models to map between those spaces. Okay, so the random flicker is encoded better by about 5 different criteria that we can think of. The only criterion that we really would love to have that we don't is whether it's how much information is being encoded as a fraction of the stimulus entropy. And that's because we don't know the stimulus entropy of the natural scene. The best estimates that we have on it, which we're pretty sure are very bad, and by those estimates, the white noise is still winning. But if it was possible that the natural scenes have, if we really knew the true structure of natural scenes, have so little entropy that the neurons are completely encoded, that could still be like formally possible. But it's certainly not an artifact that comes out of using CRTs or a certain refresh rate or whether we use this direct sort of model-free method to estimate the information or the linear reconstruction method that your group used. It doesn't matter whether we use spatial structure. It might matter that we use an anesthetized animal. It could be that our stimuli aren't natural enough. Biologists are always worried that there's no mice or conspecifics in our stimuli. I don't really think the LDN cares about that high level structure, but and the main thing, which we already touched on here, is the time scale of adaptation of the neurons. So the white noise stimulus had an entropy on order of, well, so that depends on the frame rate, right? But the one that was 8 millisecond frame rate had a 900 to something bits per second stimulus entropy, of which, you know, good self-code is about 90 bits per second, so about 10% of it. Well, that's what we don't know because we don't, the spike train entropy, comparable. But the stimulus entropy, we don't know. The natural, right, I have some really bad bounds on it. But. Yeah, so So there is this other classical literature for this field, which goes back to Dan, Attic, and Reed, that somebody already cited, that the spike trains in response to natural scenes are whitened. So what they showed is that if you take the spike train between, I think it was 3 and 15 hertz, the response to a natural stimulus looks like that, flat in that range, and the response to white noise looks like that, as you would expect from the the suppression of low frequencies that comes from the filter. In our LED experiments, we were updating the frame as much as 1,200 hertz, so we were able to thin that axis out a lot. And basically, I'm going to draw this. It's true, what they got, we see also. However, the two spectra are indistinguishable, you know, between 15 and a kilohertz, and all the information we've already found out is encoded in the 1 millisecond precision that's out here. So I think that's... But... That's the way I looked at the spectrum when I plotted them, but you're asking a different question. Is the tail gone? Yes. That's right. And so we only have... Right, so what we can say is we have the information that's encoded, you know, with a certain precision up to the correlations of the length that we can measure. Right, and then when we make an extrapolation, we're just saying if those are the only... Exactly. Or you can say if the correlations are all 30 milliseconds or less, you still would expect some corrections to the extrapolation, which you can still do, but you're still extrapolating out the consequences of the 30 millisecond order precision, right, a correlation. Yes. No. It's not. An extrapolation is a funny business, so you want one more read about that. It doesn't matter if you use short windows to get the same thing. But it could, right, you could say there's a lot of information encoded in 1 second long correlations with millisecond precision in the natural scene, and there's no way. We're just missing it because we can't measure that. Yeah. No. It's slower. you've confused me because we're talking about spatially uniform stimuli. So center and surround. Yeah. Right, right. Yeah. Right, so that would be a description of the implementation of the thing. Right. Can you put... So one thing which you have to keep in mind is that there's this disconnect between the temporal aspect of the stimulus is being encoded and the temporal sector in the spectrum that's encoding it. Right? The neurons are encoding information with 1 millisecond precision. It's not generally 1 millisecond precision events in the world. Right. And so similarly, the long, slow stuff may be redundant and not interesting in the natural scheme, but that doesn't mean that the low slots, the long correlations in the spectrum are not important. So as you can't. Can't jump there. But anyway, the way I kind of came around to this is that what we wanted to know is this the best possible neural code for natural scenes? And what we asked instead is this the best possible stimulus given for this neural code, which was really just the wrong question completely. And the reason that we looked under the light bulb run through is because this involves a model of the space of possible codes, and it's a much harder and much more interesting problem than what I think people are here talking about now. You have to do something to say, these are all the codes that the neuron could have used, and within that space of constraint, you know, is the one that it picks the best possible one. And I don't really know how to frame that in a complete way that I can solve it, but we're looking now at sort of, we say one way you could say, what are the possible codes for the LGN, and you could say, well, at least within its evolutionary moment in time, it has different codes that it uses for different stimuli, so we can take different stimuli of all different contrasts and nuances and then say, these are the sets of codes it has to choose from. Does it choose the best of the ones it has for the stimulus that it encodes? We can also take the codes that we see in different neurons and say these are the space of codes that seem to be available. And did it choose a good ensemble of codes? You can actually think it's really very interesting. Right? We're looking at a couple of cell types here. It's already been pointed out there are other cell types we're ignoring. And it might be that no one element of the Bayesian function makes any sense by itself. It may just be that the set of codes has a property that's good. It stands in place in a good way, and experimentalists are just neglecting the cells that are, coding the other axes. So, anyway, it's kind of a diffuse ending, but I think I'll just stop there and talk offline with you guys.